He passed beneath the ornate arch that led to the track, where the Red Arrow Express was waiting. The 10 cars dated back to before the First World War. 3 were freshly painted a bright red, 1 green, though that didn't detract from their antique charm. A tour group was standing beside the second car from the rear. Porters had tossed their luggage in a disorderly pile, and militiamen were looking at their passports. "Searching for me, no doubt," Volka thought as he walked right past them. He entered the train 1 car forward of the tourists and sat in one of the thinly cushioned seats. He realized that he should have brought a suitcase. It would look suspicious for someone to be going to a distant city without at least a change of clothes. He looked around as the car filled up and saw someone pushing several bags in the overhead rack. He sat under one of them, by the window. Settling in with his newspaper in his lap and his Walkman in his jacket pocket, Volka finally allowed himself to relax. That was when the cabin went quiet behind him, and he felt the cold mouth of a Makarov pistol against the back of his neck. Chapter 29, Monday, 3:10 p.m., Washington, D.C. Bob Herbert loved being busy, but not so busy that he felt like wheeling his chair out of Op Center and not stopping until he hit his hometown. No, not that Philadelphia, in Neshoba County, not far from the Alabama border. Philadelphia hadn't changed much since he was a kid. He loved going back and reflecting on happier times. They weren't necessarily more innocent times, because he remembered well the chaos that everyone from the communists to Elvis Presley caused when he was a boy. But they were problems that, for him, went away when he buried himself in a comic book or squirrel gun or behind a fishing pole at the pond. Now his page had told him that Stephen Veens at the National Reconnaissance Office had something for him to look at, and after cutting short a briefing for Ann Ferris, he swung his wheelchair into his office, shut the door, and called NRO. "Please tell me you've got photos of the nude swimming hole back in Renova," he said into the speakerphone. "I'm sure the foliage is still covering it up," Veens said. "What I've got is a plane whose heat signature we've been following for DEA. It went from Colombia to Mexico City to Honolulu, then on to Japan and Vladivostok." "The drug cartels are dealing in Russia," Herbert said. "That isn't news." "No," said Veens, "but when it landed in Vladivostok, we had a satellite in position to eyeball it. This is the first time I've ever seen a plane being unloaded by Spetsnaz troops." Herbert sat up straight. "How many?" "Less than a dozen, all in camouflage whites," Veens said. "What's more, the crates were quickly loaded onto trucks from the Pacific Fleet. We may be looking at multi-service drug dealing." Herbert thought back to the meeting between Shovich, General Kosygin, and Minister Dogin. "It could be more than just the military consorting with gangsters," he said. "Are the trucks still there?" "Yes," said Veens. "They're offloading crates by the dozens. One truck is almost completely full." "Do the crates look like they're evenly balanced?" "Perfectly," said Veens. "They're oblong, but both ends seem equally heavy." "Give a listen with the aim," Herbert said. "Let me know if there's anything rattling around in there." "Will do," Veens said. "And Steve, let me know where the trucks go," Herbert said, signing off and buzzing Mike Rogers. Rogers was out of his office and stopped by when he got the page. When Herbert was finished briefing him, Rogers said, "So, the Russians are openly consorting with the drug lords. Well, they have to get hard currency from somewhere. I'm just wondering." "Excuse me," Herbert said as his phone beeped. He punched the speaker button set in his wheelchair armrest. "Yes?"
"Bob, it's Darryl. The FBI lost their guy in Tokyo."
"What happened?"
"Gunned down by the crew of the Gulfstream," McCaskey said grimly. "The Japanese lost their self-defense force guy in the crossfire."
"Darryl, it's Mike," said Rogers. "Anyone hurt on the plane?"
"Not that we can tell, though the ground crew didn't say much. They're scared."
"Or bribed," Herbert said.
"Sorry about this, Dare. Did he have any family?"
"A father," McCaskey said. "I'll see if there's anything we can do for him."
"Right," said Herbert.
"I guess that cements the link between the plane and the Russian drug dealers," said McCaskey. "Even the Colombians aren't insane enough to have a firefight at an international airport."
"No," Herbert said. "They shoot the guys who are supposed to try the cases. They all stink deeply, and I'd love to turn Stryker loose on the lot of them."
Herbert hung up and took a second to collect himself. These things always made the intelligence officer queasy, the more so when there was any kind of family involved. He looked at Rogers.
"What was it that you were wondering a minute ago, General?"
Rogers was more somber than before.
"If this connects with what Matt found out. Our boy genius just conferenced with Paul and me," Rogers said. "He hacked the Kremlin payroll through the bank in Riyadh that holds about $10 billion in IOUs. He found out they've been employing some very expensive executives at the new TV studio in the Hermitage and in the Ministry of the Interior. People with no prior records anywhere.
Meaning that someone may have created names and identities for payroll purposes," Herbert said, "to pay people who are working secretly in St. Petersburg."
"Correct," Rogers said, "as well as to buy a lot of high-tech stuff from Japan, Germany, and the U.S., components which were sent to the Ministry of the Interior. It's beginning to smell a lot like Dugin put together a very sophisticated intelligence operation up there. Maybe Orlov is there to help with any orbital hardware they're using."
Herbert tapped his forehead.
"So, assuming Dugin is the boss man, and is tight with the Russian mafia, there's a good chance he's planning a coup. He doesn't need arms. Kosygin has those."
"No," said Rogers.
"It's what I was telling Paul earlier. What he needs is money to buy politicians, journalists, and support from abroad. And that money might very well come from Shovich in exchange for future considerations."
"Could be," Herbert agreed.
"Or Dogi may be planning to raise money by selling drugs provided by Shovich. He wouldn't be the first world leader to do that, just the biggest. He could have the crap carried around the world in diplomatic pouches by officials sympathetic to his cause."
"Makes sense," Rogers said.
"The diplomats take out drugs, come back with hard currency.
So those crates up in Vladivostok are probably a part of all this," Herbert said.
"Either drugs, money, or both."
"You know what's a real kick in the head?" Rogers said.
"If Zhanyin found out about all this, he couldn't do a damn thing. If he acted, one of two things would happen.
One," Rogers said, "he defeats Dugin, but his subsequent purge is so far-reaching and debilitating that it scares off the foreign investors he needs to rebuild the country. Result, Russia ends up in worse shape than it is. Two," Rogers continued, "Zhanyin forces his enemies to attack before they're ready, causing a long and bloody revolt with nuclear weapons in God knows whose hands. Our main concern has got to be what it was in Panama under Noriega, or Iran under the Shah. Stability, not legality."
"Good point," Herbert said.
"So what do you think the president will do?"
"Just what he did last night," Rogers said. "Nothing. He can't inform Zhanyin for fear of leaks, and he can't offer any military help. We bargained that option away. In any case, there's a danger in any kind of preemptive strike. You don't want to force Dugin and his cronies underground, or they would still be a tremendous threat."
"And how will the president explain to NATO that he's doing nothing?" Herbert said.
"They're a bunch of chicken hearts, but they'll want to rattle their sabers."
"He may rattle along with them," Rogers said. "Or if I know Lawrence, he may cloak himself in neo-isolationism and tell NATO to take a swim. That'll play well with the mood of the American public, especially in the wake of the tunnel bombing."
As Herbert sat there, tapping his leather armrest, the desk phone beeped. He glanced at the ID number on the base. It was the NRO. He put it on speaker so Rogers could hear.
"Bob," said Stephen Veans, "we haven't got your AIM reading yet, but we watched the first truck as it left the airport. It went straight to the railroad station in Vladivostok."
"What's the weather like at the site?" Herbert asked.
"Awful," said Veans, "which is probably why they did it. Real heavy snows. It's storming all over the region, in fact. And it's supposed to stay that way for at least 48 hours.
So, Dugin or Kosygin decided to transfer the goods from a grounded airplane to the railroad," Herbert said.
"Can you see anything at the station?"
"No," Veans said. "The train is inside the terminal. But we have the scheduled departures, and we'll watch anyone that leaves when it isn't supposed to."
"Thanks," Herbert said. "Keep me up to date."
When Veans clicked off, the intelligence officer contemplated the cargo being placed in an ITS target. Identifiable, trackable, strikeable.
"And important," he said under his breath.
"What was that?" Rogers asked. I said, obviously the cargo is important, Herbert said. Otherwise they'd have sat out the storm.
I agree, Rogers said. And not only is it vitally important, it's also out there in the open.
It took a moment before Herbert really heard what Rogers had said. He frowned.
No, Mike, it's not out in the open. It's heading deep into Russia, thousands of miles from any friendly border. This is not a short hop and you're back in Finland.
You're right, said Rogers. But it's also the quickest way to hamstring Dugin. No bucks, no buckshot.
Jesus, Mike, Herbert said. Think this through. Paul believes in diplomacy, not warfare. He'll never agree.
Hold on, said Rogers. Herbert sat there while Rogers went to the desk phone and buzzed Hood's executive assistant. Bugs, he said, is Paul still sitting in on the task session?
I believe so, Bugs Benet responded.
Ask him if he can come to Bob Herbert's office. Something has come up.
Will do, Benet said.
When Benet clicked off, Rogers said, We'll find out right now if he agrees.
Even if you can convince him, Herbert said, the CIC will never, in a million years, go along with this.
They already okayed a Stryker incursion into Russia, Rogers said. Daryl and Martha will have to get them to approve another.
And if they can't?
Rogers said.
What would you do, Bob?
Herbert was silent for a long moment.
Jesus, Mike, he said. You know what I'd do.
You'd send them in because it's the right mission, and they're the right team, and you know it.
Look, Rogers said, we both shoveled dirt on Bass Moore's coffin after North Korea. I was in on that incursion. I've been on other missions where troops have been killed. But that can't immobilize us. This is what we created Stryker for.
Herbert's door beeped, and he let Hood in. The director's tired eyes showed concern as they settled on Herbert.
You don't look very happy, Bob. What's up?
Rogers told him. Hood sat on the edge of Herbert's desk, listening without comment as the general informed him about the situation in Russia and his thoughts on Stryker. When he was finished, Hood asked,
How do you think our terrorists would react to this? Would it be a breach of our deal with them?
No, said Rogers. They specifically told us to stay out of Eastern Europe, not Central Russia. In any case, we'd be in and out before they knew it.
Fair enough, said Hood. On to the larger question, then. You know how I feel about force as opposed to negotiation.
Same as I do, said Rogers. Better to shoot off your mouth than a gun. But we won't be able to talk this train back to Vladivostok.
Probably not, Hood agreed,
which raises another issue entirely.
Let's assume you get an okay to send Stryker to reconnoiter and you find out what's on the train. Say it's heroin. What then? Do you seize it, destroy it, or call Zhanyin to send Russian troops to fight Russian troops?
Rogers said, When you've got a fox in your gun sight, you don't put down the rifle and call for the hounds. That's how you end up with Nazis in Poland, Castro in Cuba, and a communist Vietnam.
Hood shook his head. You're talking about attacking Russia.
Yes, I am, Rogers said. Didn't they just attack us?
That was different.
Tell that to the families of the dead, Rogers said.
He walked toward Hood.
Paul, we aren't another fat, pass-the-buck government agency. Op Center was chartered to get things done. Things the CIA and the State Department and the military can't do. We've got a chance to do that. Charlie Squires put Stryker together with the full knowledge that they would be called upon to play with fire, no different than any other elite military team, from the Spetsnaz to Oman's Royal Guard to Equatorial Guinea's Guardia Civil. What we have to work toward, what we have to believe, is that if we all do our jobs and keep our wits, this thing can be kept under wraps and dealt with.
Hood looked at Herbert.
What do you think?
Herbert shut his eyes and rubbed the lids.
As I get older, the thought of kids dying for political expediency is increasingly nauseating to me. But the Dugin, Shovich, Kosygin team is a nightmare. And like it or not, Op Center is in the front line.
What about St. Petersburg? Hood asked. We decided that cutting the brain from the body would be enough.
This dragon is bigger than we thought, Rogers said. You take off the head, the body may still be alive long enough to do some serious damage. Those drugs or money or whatever is on the train
can make that happen. Herbert rolled over to Hood. He clapped a hand on his knee.
You look as unhappy as I did, Chief.
Hood said, and now I know why. He looked at Rogers. I know you wouldn't risk your team unless you thought it was worth it. If Darrell can swing this with the CIC, do what needs to be done.
Rogers turned to Herbert. Head over to TASS. Have them draw up a plan leaving as small a Stryker contingent as possible in Helsinki, then figure out the cleanest, fastest way of getting Stryker to the train. Bounce it off Charlie each step of the way and make sure he's comfortable with it.
Oh, you know Charlie, Herbert said as he swung his wheelchair toward the door. If it involves putting his ass on the line, he'll be for it.
I know, Rogers said. He's the best of us.
Mike, Hood said, I'll brief the president on this one.
Just so you know, I'm still not behind this 100%, but I'm behind you.
Thanks, Rogers said. That's all I want or expect.
The men followed Herbert out. As he rolled alone toward the task command center, the intelligence officer found himself wondering why nothing in human affairs, whether it was the conquest of a nation or the changing of a single mind, or the pursuit of a lover, could be accomplished without struggle. It was said that trials were what made the victory so sweet, but Herbert never bought that. From where he sat, he'd settle for having the victories come a little easier now and then.
Chapter 30, Monday, 11:20 p.m., Moscow. The room was small and dark, with concrete walls and a fluorescent light overhead. There was a wooden table, a single stool, and a metal door. There were no windows. The black tile floor was faded and badly scuffed. Andrei Volka sat beneath the flickering lights in the small windowless room. He knew why he was here, and he had a good idea what was going to happen to him. The militiaman with the gun had led him from the train without a word, to two waiting armed guards, and, together, the four of them had climbed into a police car and come to the station on Dzerzhinsky Street, not far from the old KGB headquarters. Volka had been handcuffed at the station. As he sat on the stool feeling utterly helpless, he wondered how they found out about him. He assumed it was through something Fields Hutton had left behind. Not that it mattered. He tried not to think how long and hard he would be beaten until his captors believed he knew absolutely nothing about any operatives, apart from the ones they'd already taken. More important, he wondered how many days it would be before he was tried, imprisoned, and finally awakened one morning and shot in the head. What lay ahead seemed surrealistic. He could only hear his thumping heart as it beat loudly in his ears. Every now and then a wave of terror rolled through him, a mix of fear and despair that caused him to ask himself, "How have I come to this point in my life?" A decorated soldier, a good son, a man who had only wanted what was due to him. A key turned and the door swung open. Three guards entered the room. Two men wore uniforms and carried clubs. The third man was young, short, and dressed in crisply pressed brown trousers and a white shirt without any tie. He had a round face with gentle eyes and smoked a strong-smelling cigarette. The two guards positioned themselves alongside the open door, legs spread wide apart, blocking it.
"My name is Pogodin," the young man said firmly as he watched him. "And you are in quite a bit of trouble. We found the telephone in your cassette machine. Your fellow traitor in St. Petersburg had one also. However, unlike you, he had the misfortune of falling into the hands of a Spetsnaz officer who dealt with him rather harshly. We also have the labels from the English tea bags you served the British spy. Very clever. I imagine you passed information inside them, then cleared the table so no one would ever notice the missing labels. There were fibers from one of the labels in his wallet. We wouldn't have found you if not for that. Do you deny any of this?"
Volka said nothing. He wasn't feeling especially brave, but all he had left was his self-respect. He wasn't about to lose it.
Pogodin was standing right beside Volka, looking down at him. "Commendable. Most people in your position screech like birds. Perhaps you don't know of our reputation for obtaining information?"
"I know," Volka said. Pogodin regarded him for a moment. He looked as though he was trying to decide whether Volka was brave or stupid.
"Would you care for a cigarette?"
The waiter shook his head.
Would you care to save your life and repay some of the debt you owe to your country?
Volker looked up at his youthful captor.
I see that you would, Bogodin said.
He used his cigarette to point to the men behind him.
Shall I send them away so we can talk?
Volker thought for a moment, then nodded. Bogodin told them to go, and they shut the door behind them as they left. The young man walked around Volker to the table and perched on the edge.
You were expecting somewhat different treatment, weren't you? Bogodin asked.
When? Volker said. Today? Or when I returned from Afghanistan with a broken back and a pension that wouldn't support a dog?
Ah, bitterness, Bogodin said. A greater motivator than anger because it doesn't pass. So, you betrayed Russia because your pension was too small?
No, Volker said. Because I felt betrayed. I was in pain every moment I worked, every time I stood.
Bogodin poked his chest with a thumb.
And I'm in pain each day I think of my grandfather being crushed by a tank in Stalingrad, or my two elder brothers killed by snipers in Afghanistan. And men like you betraying what they died for because you felt uncomfortable. Is that all the affection you can muster for Russia?
Volker looked straight ahead.
A man has to eat, and in order to eat he must work. I would have been fired from the hotel if the Englishman hadn't insisted they keep me. He spent a great deal of money there.
Bogodin shook his head.
I should tell my superiors at the Ministry of Security that you are unapologetic and would sell your country again for a price.
That wasn't what I wanted, Volker said. It never was, and it isn't now.
No, said Bogodin, drawing on his cigarette. Because now your friends are dead and you're facing death.
He leaned toward the waiter, blowing smoke from both nostrils.
Here's how it can be different, Andrei Volka. Why were you heading to St. Petersburg?
To meet someone. I didn't know that he was already dead.
Bogodin slapped the waiter hard across the cheek. You weren't going to meet the Englishman or the Russian. You wouldn't have been told who the latter was, and besides, they were already dead, and DI-6 knew it. When the Spetsnaz officer tried to use their concealed telephones, the lines were inactive. He was too impatient. You have an ID to enter first, correct?
Volker remained silent.
Of course, correct, Bogodin said. So, you were headed to St. Petersburg to meet someone else.
Who?
Volker continued to stare ahead, his terror supplanted by shame. He knew what was coming, what Bogodin had in mind, and he knew he would have a terrible choice to make.
I don't know, Volker said. I was...
Go on.
Volker took a long, tremulous breath.
I was to go there, contact London, and await further instructions.
Were they going to try and get you into Finland? Bogodin asked.
That was my impression, Volker said.
Bogodin smoked while he thought, then rose and looked down at the waiter. I'll be frank, Andrei. The only way you can save yourself is to help us learn more about the British operation. Are you willing to go to St. Petersburg as planned and work with us instead of with the enemy?
Willing, Volka said. In a relationship that began with a gun at my neck?
Bogodin said coldly, and it will end with one there if you don't cooperate.
Volka looked into the tester of smoke hanging under the lights. He tried to tell himself that he would be acting patriotically, but he knew that wasn't the case. He was just afraid.
Yes, Volker said sullenly, I'll go to St. Petersburg.
He looked into Bogodin's eyes.
Willingly.
Bogodin glanced at his wristwatch.
There's a cabin reserved for us. It won't even be necessary to hold the train.
He looked at Volker and smiled now.
I'm going with you, of course. And though I don't carry a gun, I trust you'll still be willing to cooperate.
There was menace in his tone, and Volker was still too shaken to answer. He didn't want other people to die on his account,
but he also knew that everyone who played in this field knew the risks, himself included. As his captor led him from the interrogation room back to the car, he told himself that he had two choices. One was to accept Pogodin's terms and earn himself a quick death. The other was to fight back and try to regain the honor he had somehow lost. Chapter 31. Monday, 10:05 p.m., Berlin. The fat, heavy Ilyushin Il-76T was a high-performance Russian transport just over 165 feet long, with a wingspan of over 165 feet. First introduced in prototype in 1971 and first flown in service with the Soviet Air Force in 1974, it could take off from short, unpaved airstrips, making it ideal for environments like those found in Siberia. It was also modified as a flight refueling tanker for Russian supersonic strategic bombers. Il-76Ts had been sold to Iraq, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. Powered by four mighty Solovyov D-30KP turbofans, the jet had a normal cruising speed of nearly 500 miles an hour and a range of over 4,000 miles. The Il-76T could transport 40 tons of cargo. If it were flying nearly empty, and if relatively lightweight rubber fuel bladders were installed in the cargo bay with extra fuel, the range could be increased by over 70%. After contacting the Pentagon and explaining that Stryker needed a ride into Russia, Bob Herbert was put in touch with General David Dive Bomb Peril in Berlin, who had the Husky jet hauled from secret storage. It had been kept at the U.S. air base there since 1976, when it had been bought by the Shah of Iran and then clandestinely sold to the U.S. After studying the aircraft, the Air Force had gutted it for use as a spy plane. To date, the Il-76T had been used in only a handful of missions, measuring exact distances between landmarks to help calibrate spy satellites and taking radar and heat readings of underground installations to get a picture of their layout. On all of these flights, it had managed to fool the Russians as to its legitimacy by filing a flight plan through a mole in the Air Force. The mole was informed by radio to do it again for this flight. This was the first time the Il-76T was going to be used to carry American troops, and the first time it would spend this much time over Russian airspace, 8 hours as it flew from Helsinki to the drop-off point, and then on to Japan. In the past, it was never in the air long enough to be spotted, discovered to be unregistered, and investigated. Both Herbert and Peril were keenly aware of the danger the crew and the Stryker team faced, and both of them expressed their deep reservations to Mike Rogers in a conference call. Rogers shared their concerns and asked for alternative suggestions. Peril agreed with Herbert that while the operation was within Op Center's jurisdiction, the political issue was a matter for the State Department and the White House to decide. Rogers reminded Herbert and pointed out to the general that until they knew for a fact what was on that train, this was strictly a reconnaissance matter. Until that situation changed, he had no choice but to pursue this course of action, regardless of the danger. On-site intelligence gathering, he said, was never risk-free, and there were times, like now, when it was indispensable. And so the Il-76T was prepped and loaded with paratroop and cold-weather gear and took off, headed to Helsinki with special clearance from Defense Minister Kalle Niskanen. Though he was told that the flight was only to reconnoiter, not that troops would almost certainly be jumping into Russia. That was a problem Lowell Coffey would have to smooth over once the plane was airborne, though the fiercely anti-Russian minister probably wouldn't have a problem with anything they wanted to do there. Meanwhile, Herbert contacted the Op Center radio room and asked to be patched through to Lieutenant Colonel Squires. Chapter 32. Monday, 11:27 p.m., south of Finland. It isn't hypocritical, Squires told Sandra as the Starlifter began its final approach to Helsinki Airport. The Strykers had changed into civilian clothes and looked like any other tourists. Yes, coffee is a stimulant, and it might be bad for your stomach if consumed by the barrel. But wine is bad for your liver and your mind.
Not in moderation, Sandra said as she checked her gear again. And wine tasters have as much right to fuss over vintage and flavor and body as someone does over coffee.
I don't fuss over coffee, Squire said. I don't swirl it around my redskin's mug and savor the aroma. I drink it, period. I also don't pretend that getting high sip by sip in an elegant setting is elegant. He chopped down with his hand. End of debate. Sandra scowled as she zipped up the nondescript backpack that contained a compass, 9-inch hunting knife, M9 45 caliber pistol, $1,000 in cash, and maps of the region that had been printed out by Squire's computer during the flight. It wasn't fair for him to pull rank like that, but she reminded herself that no one ever said the military was fair, that rank had its privileges, and all the other clichés her parents had thrown at her when she'd told them she wanted to join the military straight out of Columbia. "If you want to travel, travel," her father had said. "We can afford it. Take a year." But that wasn't it. Carl Custard Devone had been a self-starter who made a fortune in soft ice cream in New England, and he didn't understand why an only daughter, who had everything, would want to take her B.A. in literature and join the Navy. Not just the Navy, but fight her way into the SEALs. Maybe it was because she had had everything as a kid and wanted to test herself. Or maybe she needed to do something her overachieving father hadn't. And the SEALs, and now Stryker, were certainly a test. While she wondered how a man as bright as Squire's could be so stubborn, a call came in from Op Center. He took it, listened, intently as always, mostly without speaking, and then handed the phone back to Ishihanda. "Okay, lady and gentlemen, gather round," he said, hunching toward his troops like a quarterback in a huddle. "Here's the latest. Private George, when we reach Helsinki, you'll be remaining behind. Daryl McCaskey has arranged for you to link up with a Major Aho of the Finnish Ministry of Defense. The Major will take you to your partner, DI-6 operative Peggy James, and the two of you will take on the Hermitage by your lonesomes. Sorry, but the rest of us have business elsewhere. You'll hitch a midget sub-ride from the Gulf of Finland into the Neva. The Finns have got a butt-kick defense minister who's been running surveillance trips right into the mouth of the river. The Russians don't monitor closely because manpower is stretched thin and Moscow doesn't worry a whole lot about being attacked by Finland."
"Sloppy," Sandra observed.
"You and James will raft into St. Petersburg in daylight," Squires continued. "General Rogers would have preferred for you to wait for nightfall, but that's when they make the mini-sub trips, so in you go. Fortunately, the Russian Navy maintains a mini-sub base in Kaporsky Zalif Bay, not far from the city. You'll be given Russian naval uniforms when you reach Helsinki. If you're stopped for any reason, Ms. James speaks fluent Russian, and you'll have the appropriate documents. The Finns are turning out Russian papers in the Security Ministry's forgery division. Major Aho will give you your cover story, as well as visas and papers, so you can get out of the country as Russian soldiers on leave. Once you reach the Hermitage, find out anything you can about the communications center they appear to have down there. If you can cripple it without terminating anyone, do so. Any questions?"
"Yes, sir. I assume Major Aho's in charge of the mission while we're in Finland. Who runs it in Russia?"
Squire's jaw shifted to the side. "I was getting to that. Op Center's come up with a new one for us. James was going to be a subordinate as long as an officer was present. Since there isn't going to be one, me, she's along as an observer. In other words, she's not obliged to take orders from you."
"Sir?"
"I know it's an odd one, Private. All I can tell you is do your job. If she has ideas, listen to them. If she doesn't like yours, negotiate. She's a sharp player, so it should be okay. Any other questions?"
George saluted.
"No, sir."
If he was concerned or excited, it didn't show in his rosy, youthful face.
"Okay," Squires looked around. "The rest of us will be taking a little trip. We'll be transferring to a Russian transport we've had in cold storage and flying to parts unknown. The rest of our mission will be communicated en route."
"Any idea what it is, sir?" Sandra asked.
Squire's steely eyes were on her.
"If I did," said the lieutenant colonel, "I'd have told you. The minute I know anything, you'll know it."
Sandra managed to hold his gaze with her own, though her exuberance dissolved like the sugar she dared to use in her coffee.
Their conversations earlier, and now this rebuke, had shown her a side of Squire's she hadn't seen during her month with Stryker. Not the driving, blistering, try-harder-move-your-ass-can't-you-hit-a-damn-bullseye side, but the imperious commander.
The change from taskmaster to leader was subtle but demanding. It was also, she had to admit, impressive. As Squires dismissed the troops and Sandra sat back down, she shut her eyes and did what they'd taught her in SEAL training. Worked on whipping up her enthusiasm again, reminding herself that she wasn't here for Squires, but for herself and for her country.
"Private?"
Sandra opened her eyes. The lieutenant colonel was leaning close so he could be heard over the drone of the engines, his expression less forbidding than it had been moments before.
"Yes, sir."
"A bit of advice," he said. "Back at the base, you had one of the greatest go-get'em attitudes I've ever seen. I don't know who you were mad at or who you were trying to impress up here."
He touched his temple.
"You sure impressed me, though. You also have skill and smarts, or you wouldn't be here. But what the rest of my team knows, Private Devone, is that on a mission, the cardinal virtues are the cardinal virtues. Prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice. You understand?"
"I think so, sir."
"I'll put it another way," Squire said as he sat up and buckled up for the landing. "Keep everything open except your mouth and you'll do just fine."
Sandra slipped on her own shoulder harness and leaned back. She was still a little deflated and somewhat annoyed that the lieutenant colonel had chosen this time and this way to share his philosophy, but feeling more confident than ever that here was a man she could follow into battle. Chapter 33, Monday, 4:30 p.m., Washington, D.C. While Rogers sat in his office reviewing the latest Stryker plans from TASS, Stephen Veens emailed the AIM satellite report on the crates. "Contents of each crate appears to be a solid mass. Probably not machinery. Easy for two men to lift. Sent photo recon to Matt Stoll for analysis." Rogers muttered to himself, "Bricks of cocaine or packets of heroin would fit the bill, and I'd love to make the bastards eat each and every one of them." There was a knock on the door. Rogers buzzed Low Coffee in.
"You wanted to see me?"
Coffee asked. Rogers waved him to a chair. Coffee removed his black trench coat and planted himself in the leather armchair. The attorney had bags under his eyes, and his hair wasn't as carefully combed as usual. This had been a long, tough day for him.
"How did it go with the Congressional Intelligence Oversight Committee?" Rogers asked.
Coffey tugged his LC cufflinks out from under the sleeve of his jacket.
"I went over our revised outline with Senators Fox and Carlin and was told we're crazy. Senator Fox said it twice. The answer was no change in the original Stryker mandate. I think they have a problem with the prospect of engaging the Russian army, Mike."
"I can't worry about the problems they have," Rogers said. "I need my team in there. Go back and tell them we're not talking about an engagement, Lowell. We're just reconnoitering."
"Just reconnoitering," Coffey said dubiously.
"They'll never buy that. I don't buy it. I mean, reconnoitering to find out what? Where the soldiers are headed and exactly what they're guarding."
"You'll have to get on the train for that," Coffey said. "That's some pretty close reconnoitering.
And if Stryker is found out, what do I tell the senators? Do we surrender or fight?"
Rogers said bluntly, "Stryker doesn't surrender."
"Then forget my even going back," he said.
"All right," Rogers said, "tell them we won't fight. Tell them we won't use anything stronger than flashbang grenades and tear gas. We'll put everyone to sleep, no one gets hurt."
"I still can't do it," Coffey said. "I can't take that to the committee."
"Then screw 'em," Rogers said. "Hell, we're still breaking international law even if we get their approval."
"True," Coffey said, "but if we get caught, then it's Congress in the hot seat, and we don't get crucified. Do you have any idea how many national and international laws and treaties you can conceivably break with this one action you're proposing? The good news is you'll never go to jail. You'll spend 40 years in court fighting each of the charges."
Rogers thought for a moment.
"What if you tell the committee that it isn't the Russian government we'll be going up against?"
"In Russia? Who else would we be fighting?"
"We believe a rogue official very high up is in bed with drug lords," Rogers said.
"Then why haven't we told the Russian leaders?" Coffey asked. "If he were to invite us in..."
"He can't," said Rogers.
The election didn't leave President Jeanyin strong enough to deal with the rebel faction. Coffey considered the new information.
Rogue officials. Elected ones?
Rogers shook his head. Appointed by the last president and sure to be gone when Jeanyin finds the broom. Coffey chewed the inside of his cheek.
That plus the drug angle could work. Congress likes tackling bad guys the constituents can hate. What about the president? Is he behind us on this, or are we on our own?
Paul told him what we were proposing to do, Rogers said. He doesn't like the downside, but he's itching to hit someone for what happened in New York.
And Paul's behind you, I assume.
He is, said Rogers. As long as you can get me CIC approval.
Coffey crossed his leg. He shook a foot nervously on his knee.
I assume you're going to use something other than the Starlifter to get Stryker in.
We've taken an IL-76T from mothballs in Berlin and sent it to Helsinki.
Wait a minute, Coffey said.
Ambassador Filmanard got the government to okay a Russian incursion?
No, Rogers said. Bob went to the Minister of Defense.
Niskanen?
Coffey shouted.
I told you this morning he's crazy. That's why the Finns keep him in office. He actually scares Moscow. But he can't give the final okay for something like this. You need approvals from President Jarva and Prime Minister Lumiraier.
Rogers said, all I needed from Niskanen was permission to get the plane in. Once my team is airborne, he or you or the ambassador can deal with the president and prime minister. Coffey shook his head.
Mike, you're all over the map on this one, and every inch of it's an earthquake zone.
There was a knock on the door, and Daryl McCaskey entered. Am I interrupting something?
Yes, said Coffey, but that's okay.
Rogers said, I heard about the agent in Tokyo. Sorry. The short FBI liaison and crisis management expert scratched his prematurely gray hair and handed papers to Rogers. He died with his boots on, McCaskey said. I guess that's something. Coffey shut his eyes as Rogers turned his attention to the papers. These were faxed from Interpol, McCaskey said. Maps drawn up just after the fall of Poland showing the basement of the Hermitage. The Russians knew they'd be going to war, so they gutted the cellars, reinforced them to bunker strength, and drew up plans to move the local government and military command down there in the event of an attack. You've got 18-inch thick cinder block walls and ceilings, plumbing, vents. Very little would have to have been done to turn it into a secure area for intelligence work. Rogers looked over the architectural plans. That's what I would have done with it. I wonder why they waited so long. Interpol says the basement was, in fact, used on and off over the years for radio surveillance around the world, McCaskey said. But you know the Russians. Whenever possible, they prefer on-site intelligence over electronic surveillance. The peasant mentality, Rogers said. A potato in the hand is worth a dozen in some rosy 5-year plan. Basically, yes, said McCaskey. But with moles being sniffed out and the collapse of the KGB, that may be changing now. Thanks, Rogers said. Get this over to Squire so he can review them with the man going into St. Petersburg. He looked at Coffey. For people operating on fault lines, we appear to be doing some pretty good spy work. How about working on getting those clearances we'll need as soon as Stryker is airborne again, which will be, he looked at his computer clock, in about an hour. Coffey looked numb. He nodded as he rose, then tugged his cufflinks again and looked at Rogers.
One more thing, Mike. As an attorney and a friend, I should point out to you that according to our charter, Section 7, accountability of military personnel to civilian commanders, subsection B, paragraph 2, Stryker reports to the ranking military officer. That's you. The director can't countermand an order you've given.
I know the charter almost as well as I know Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic War. What's your point, Lowell? Coffey said,
if I fail to get congressional approval and Paul takes their thumbs down seriously, the only way he can recall Stryker is by dismissing you and appointing another deputy director. If he needed to do that quickly, he could go to the duty officers.
I wouldn't put him in that position, Rogers said. I'd recall Stryker if he asked me to. But in here, he stood and touched his gut, I don't think Paul will do that.
We're a crisis management team, and as long as we do everything we can to ensure the safety of our Striker force, we're going to manage this crisis.
You guys may end up out there all alone, Coffey told him.
Only if it doesn't work out, Del McCaskey observed. Our asses were supposed to be grass after North Korea, but we won that and no one complained. Rogers patted Coffey on the arm and returned to Hood's desk.
Don't go writing epitaphs, Lowell. I've been reading Churchill lately, and something he told the Canadian Parliament in December 1941 seems appropriate. He said, when I warned them that Britain would fight on alone whatever they did, their generals told their prime minister and his divided cabinet, in 3 weeks, England will have her neck wrung like a chicken. Rogers smiled. Churchill's answer, gentlemen, may just become Opcenter's new motto. Some chicken, some neck.
Chapter 34, Monday, 11:44 p.m., Helsinki.
The Starlifter landed on a remote runway at the corner of the Helsinki airport, and Major Aho was there to meet it. The tall weightlifter introduced himself in fluent English to Lieutenant Colonel Squires as a token black-haired Lap in the military. As the representative of Defense Minister Niskanen, he said he had specific instructions to give the Americans whatever they needed. As they stood in the open door of the aircraft, the cold wind swirling in from the dark night, Squires told him the only thing he wanted was to close the door and wait for the IL-76T.
I understand, said Aho, whose sonorous voice, like his carriage, had great dignity.
Leaving an aide behind to work as a liaison with the ground crew, Aho waited while Private George accepted and tendered a round of good luck wishes, then escorted him to a waiting car. Both men sat in the back.
Have you ever been to Finland, Private George? Aho asked.
Sir, said the soldier, until I joined the army, I'd never been out of Lubbock, Texas. After I joined, I never got out of Virginia till now. I wasn't around for the first mission. On the second mission to Philadelphia, I was sick. On the third mission to Korea, I got myself bumped by a general.
In life, as in chess, king takes pawn.
Major Aho smiled.
At least you'll be making up for it this time out. You get to visit two countries.
George returned his smile. There was a priestly benevolence to the Major's expression and a softness in his fair eyes that George had never seen in a military officer. But beneath Aho's tight brown uniform, George also saw muscle definition he'd never seen, except in bodybuilding competitions on cable TV.
But you're fortunate, said the Major. The Viking men believed that a foreign warrior who came to Finland first, in peace, is invincible in battle.
Only the men believe that, sir? Aho sighed.
It was a different world, Private. And you haven't met your partner, is that correct?
That's correct, sir. Though I'm looking forward to it, George said diplomatically. In fact, she worried him.
He had read the dossier that was faxed to the plane, and wasn't at all sure he was ready for a civilian barnstormer.
I wouldn't say this to her, Aho said, leaning toward him conspiratorially. But Viking society was always about warrior men. Each man carried an axe, a dagger, and a sword on his person at all times, and wore garments of fox or beaver or even squirrel that left one arm free, his fighting arm. Each woman wore a box on either breast, made of iron, copper, silver, or gold, indicating the wealth of her husband. She also wore a neck ring to show her subservience to him. We had a bit of a row in the schools years ago about how to teach the history of these people.
He settled back into his seat.
You can't offend women. You can't offend the British, who were victims of the Vikings. You can't offend the Christians, who were killed by the heathens. Heathens who didn't want to see their cultures destroyed like those of the Visigoths, Ostrogoths, Burgundians, Lombards, and Alemanni. Fortunately, accuracy won over political expediency. Can you imagine being ashamed of a history such as ours?
No, sir, George said, then looked out at the starry night sky.
It was the same sky the Vikings had looked at. In awe or fear, George wondered. He couldn't imagine that the Vikings were afraid of anything but dishonor. His own training, like the training of Navy SEALs and the Army's Delta Unit, or the Russian Spetsnaz, emphasized attitude as well as physical skills.
Not just 24-hour marches with a 55-pound rucksack to keep you in shape, but the belief that while death is fast, failure stays with you for a lifetime. And George believed that utterly. Still, he couldn't deny that he felt a lot better when he overdressed, wearing a hip pouch stuffed with flash grenades, a Kevlar bulletproof vest with lapel daggers for hand-to-hand combat, his Leland and Birmingham respirator, and carrying a few spare 9mm magazines. Instead, in his rucksack, he had ANPVS-7A night vision goggles, an ANPAS-7 thermal viewer to see hidden objects by the heat they generated, and his Heckler & Koch MP5-SD3, with a collapsing stock and integral silencer. Even the bolt noise was absorbed by rubber buffers, which, used with subsonic ammunition, couldn't be heard 15 feet away. And his passport. He had that, too. That was the exit strategy Daryl McCaskey had come up with. "I don't think your ancestors did anything like what we're doing, though, sir," George said, trying not to let the details distract him. He turned away from the sprawling beauty of the Milky Way as the car entered the city proper and turned onto the main boulevard, the Pollo Esplanadi, the Northern Esplanade, which runs east and west through the center of the city. "I mean, it would have been kind of difficult to sneak a Viking with 3 weapons and a horned helmet into another country unnoticed."
"True," said Aho. "Nor did they want to sneak in. They believed in panicking the countryside as they approached their target, forcing local officials to deal with domestic unrest as well as the invaders."
"And here we are, sir, coming by mini-sub," George said.
"We call them midget marauders," said Aho. "A little more gung-ho, don't you think?"
"Yes, sir," George said, as they stopped in front of the majestic, sprawling presidential palace, which was built for the Russian czars who ruled the city starting in 1812, after fires burned down the wooden buildings that Queen Christina of Sweden had built there over the previous 2 centuries. Aho led the private through a side entrance. The palace was quiet at this hour. After presenting his credentials to a guard, Aho greeted several members of the skeletal night staff, then took George to a small office at the far end of a narrow, dimly lighted corridor. Beside the 6-panel door was a bronze plaque that said, "Defense Minister." Aho used 2 keys to let them in.
"Minister Niskanen has several offices in the city," said Aho. "He uses this one when he is on good terms with the president. He is not using it now."
The major grinned and said quietly,
"There's something else that's changed. In the days of generals like Halfdan, or Olaf Tryggvason, or monarchs like Knut, or Svein Forkbeard, leaders didn't take disagreements to a parliament, or Congress, or the press. They put a slave girl up against the wall, threw axes at her, and the man who hit her lost. Then everyone went back to drinking, and the dispute was forgotten."
"I can see where that wouldn't work today, sir," George noted.
"Oh, it would work," Aho said. "It just wouldn't be very popular."
A light was on, and George saw a woman standing behind the desk, leaning on her rigid arms and looking down at a map. She was slight, with large blue eyes framed by short-cropped, dirty blonde hair. Her mouth was small and her lips naturally ruddy. Her nose was strong and ended in a little upturn, and her skin was extremely pale with a faint smattering of freckles on her cheeks. She was dressed in a black jumpsuit.
"Miss James," said Aho as he shut the door and doffed his hat, "Private George."
"Glad to meet you, ma'am," George said, smiling at her as he put down his rucksack. Peggy looked up briefly, then resumed examining her map.
"Good evening, Private," she said. "You look like you're about 15.
Her clipped accent and brusque manner reminded George of a young Betty Davis.
15 and a half, he said, walking toward the desk. "If you mean neck size."
She looked up.
"And you're a comedian."
"I have many talents, ma'am," he said. Still smiling, George leapt on the desk, his feet straddling the map. In the same quick move, he'd snatched up a letter opener and put the blade to Peggy's throat.
"I've also been trained to kill quickly and silently."
Their eyes locked, and almost at once George realized that that had been a mistake. She'd done it to distract him as she brought her rigid forearms together hard on either side of his wrist. The letter opener clattered to the desktop, and a moment later she swung her stiff right leg across the map, kicking his legs out from under him. As he fell to his side, she grabbed the front of his shirt and pulled him to the floor, dropping him on his back and putting her foot on his neck.
"Just make sure," she said, "that if you plan to kill, you do it without the speech. All right?"
"All right," he said, kicking up with both feet so that he was momentarily resting on his shoulder blades. Locking his ankles around Peggy's neck, he pulled her down and flipped her onto her back. "Though I'll make an exception this time." George kept the operative in a chokehold for several seconds to teach her a lesson, and then released her. As she sucked down air, he helped her to her feet.
"Impressive," she gasped, rubbing her throat with her left hand. "But you missed one thing."
"What, ma'am?" She showed him the letter opener in her right hand.
"I grabbed it when you brought me down. The way you were holding me, I could have stuck you anywhere."
Rubbing her throat, Peggy returned to the map while Private George looked at the letter opener and silently cursed himself. It didn't bother him that a woman had bested him. In training, Sandra and he had knocked each other around mercilessly. But on a mission, missing something like the letter opener would have meant the difference between living and dying. Still standing by the closed door, Aho said,
"Now that the introductions have been made, perhaps you'd care to go to work."
Peggy nodded.
"When you reach the boat at the harbor," Aho said, "your password for the boat will be Wonderful Stem Post. The response is Handsome Dragonhead. Private George, I've already explained the process of gaining access to the midget submarine to Ms. James. I've also given her money and the Russian uniforms you're to wear." He grinned. "We have more Russian uniforms here and better fitting than the Russians do."
He took a sealed packet from inside his jacket pocket and handed it to Private George.
"Here are the papers identifying you as a principal shipboard starshina Yevgeny Glebov and senior sailor Ada Lundver in the Russian Navy. You're the sailor, Miss James, assigned to coastal mapping and buoy refurbishing. This means that if anyone sees you, you'll have to look like you're following Private George's orders."
"He doesn't speak Russian," she said. "How will that work?"
"You've got a 90-minute boat ride and a 10-hour submarine trip to teach him some basics," Aho said.
He put his hat back on.
"And that covers everything, I believe. Further questions?"
"None, sir," George said. Peggy shook her head.
"Very well, then," said the Major. "Good luck."
George picked up the heavy rucksack containing his gear and jogged after Major Aho, who opened the door, walked into the hallway, and shut the door behind him. George stopped short to avoid running into the door. "Officers," he said with a disgusted sigh as he reached for the knob.
"Don't,"
Peggy barked. George turned around.
"Excuse me?" "Put your gear down," Peggy said. "You and I aren't going anywhere."
"What do you mean?" She took an instant camera from atop a filing cabinet.
"Smile," she said.
As Major Aho left the building, a woman and her dog were standing by the calm waters of the South Harbor watching him. Valya had ridden her bicycle from the apartment of their longtime Helsinki operative, a retired Finnish policeman, and had leaned it against a high lamp post while she walked away from the cone of light. When she was safely hidden in darkness, she let the dog rest from its short run, a cuddly, less energetic Springer Spaniel, having replaced the wild Jack Russell Terrier she'd used against the British agent in St. Petersburg. Valya didn't need to deactivate anyone here. She had come over simply to watch and report back to Colonel Roski. It had been easy for the Operations Center to track the jet from the United States, and even easier for her to follow the Major and his American friend when they left the airport. Now her driver was waiting out of sight on Kanavakatu by the tall, majestic Uspensky Cathedral, and she was watching to see what the Finnish officer and his spy did. His two spies, she noted, as two companions joined Aho when he walked toward his car. When she was sure they were going inside, Valya tugged on the dog's collar, and it began to bark loudly, twice, twice again, and then two more times.
"Ruthie!"
Valya shouted, tugging on the leash a second time. The well-trained dog fell silent. Major Aho looked over, apparently failed to see anyone in the darkness, then slid into the passenger's side of his car, the other two climbing in the back. Beyond them, the Russian saw her partner's Volvo swing onto the esplanade, alerted by the bark. They had agreed beforehand that he would follow the car to see where it went, then come back for her. She wanted to remain behind and make sure no one else popped out of this wing of the palace. Having lost two agents, they might take unusual precautions to protect more. Some countries did that as a matter of course. 5 years before, when she first joined the Spetsnaz Intelligence Bureau, her superior had been stung by a fake English operation covering the real one, and he took his life after being dismissed in disgrace. Valya Saparov had no intention of letting that happen to her. She continued to stroll along the steps of the embankment, listening to the tranquil waters lap against the stone and into the drain pipes, watching the few cars and even fewer pedestrians that came and went along the thoroughfare. And then she saw something that brought a smile to her lips. Two people leaving the presidential palace, people who looked suspiciously like the ones who had departed with the officer shortly before. Chapter 35. Tuesday, 1:08 a.m., St. Petersburg. When he was making regular trips into space, General Orlov was accustomed to having his days and nights carefully regulated. When he would eat, sleep, work, shower, and exercise. When he began training others, he held to a tightly controlled regimen because it worked for him. In the 2 years he'd been attached to the operations center, his regimen had deteriorated because of the demands on his time. He didn't exercise quite as much as he wanted, and that made him unhappy. In the last few weeks, as the online hour drew near, he hadn't slept as much either, and that made him even more cranky. He had expected to be up late today, helping to iron out any problems with the various systems, though there were surprisingly few. And he had even been prepared, if necessary, to run an urgent counterintelligence operation using Ruski's Spetsnaz intelligence operatives based in nearby Pushkin. Fortunately, word had reached Ruski that Ministry of Security agents had found and arrested the waiter who'd been working with the British spy and were bringing him to St. Petersburg. No doubt he could be persuaded to help them ferret out other spies, a more effective tack than Ruski's ham-fisted handling of those two operatives. Orlov didn't believe for a moment that the British agent had taken his own life, and he was sorry that they hadn't had the opportunity to interrogate him. Disappointment and the ability to adapt were part of any job, and Orlov remained focused and alert. But he hated waiting for anything, especially missing pieces of a puzzle. In space, whenever he had to troubleshoot, there was a checklist. Here there was nothing to do but sit and keep busy while awaiting information. The message came from Valya Saparov at 1:09 in the morning, just after midnight in Helsinki. Because she hadn't wanted to carry secure radio gear, she placed a straightforward international call from a phone booth in Helsinki to a number at the St. Petersburg telephone exchange. There, an operations center employee routed the call to the intelligence base, where someone in the radio room picked up. In this way, telephone calls couldn't be traced to or from the operations center. Calls from agents over unsecured lines were in the form of personal messages to friends, relatives, or roommates. If the operative didn't preface the message by asking to speak to someone in particular, the center knew to disregard the contents. Messages were sometimes sent this way to confuse eavesdroppers who might be tracking a spy or trying to make sense of what they were reporting. When the operative said something about the weather, the listener knew that that was when the message proper began. Valya asked for Uncle Boris, her name for Colonel Ruski, and he was notified by an operator at one of the 9 computers linked to the phone and radio lines. He grabbed a headset and took the call. General Orlov took a duplicate pair from the operator and pressed one side to an ear, listening as a digital recorder taped the call.
"My little petitsa," Ruski said. "My precious bird. How was your visit with your Karol?"
He used a nickname, King, so a listener wouldn't be able to check on anyone's identity.
"Very well," she said. "Sorry to call so late, but I've been busy. The weather couldn't be better for sightseeing."
"Good," said Ruski.
"I'm out with the dog now, in fact. Karol went to the airport with 2 friends, but I didn't want to go. I decided to take a bicycle ride to the harbor instead."
"You thought you might end up there," Ruski said. "Is it nice?"
"Very," said Valya. "I watched 2 people getting ready for a trip on the Gulf."
She'd said on the Gulf and not in it, Orlov noted. That was significant. They were traveling on the surface, and not by submarine.
"They're going to sea in the dark?" Ruski asked.
"Yes," said Valya. "A curious time to travel, but they are in a very fast boat and seem to know what they're doing. Besides, uncle, I suspect they want to watch the sunrise from somewhere beautiful. A man and a woman. Very romantic, don't you think?
Quiet, Roski said. Precious, I don't want you out so late. Why don't you go home and we'll talk tomorrow?
I will, she said. Have a good night.
A pensive Orlov handed the earphones back to the operator and thanked him while Roski doffed his own set. The colonel's expression was tense as he followed the general to his office. Though the message could be read by anyone in the command center, Orlov didn't want their options discussed openly. Moles could be anywhere.
They are audacious, Roski said angrily when the door was shut. Coming in by boat?
It's our fault for not taking the Finns more seriously, Orlov said, sitting on the edge of his desk. The question is, do we want these two to come in or stop them in the Gulf?
Set foot on Russia, Roski said. Never!
We watch them by satellite and stop them the moment they enter Russian waters.
He was staring past Orlov as though he were thinking aloud and not addressing a superior officer.
Standard operating procedure would be to drop mines from fishing boats, but I wouldn't want to tweak Minister Niskanen's nose so openly. No, he went on. I'll have the Navy send the radio-controlled mini-sub from the sea terminal on Gogland Island. A collision. We report losses of our own. Blame it on the Finns.
Standard operating procedure, Orlov said. But I repeat, what if we allow them to come in? Roski's eyes returned to the general. They were no longer enthusiastic, but glazed with anger.
General, may I ask you a question?
Of course.
Is it your intention, sir, to stop me at every turn?
Yes, Orlov admitted, where your tactics and ideas run counter to the mandate of this center.
Our mission is to gather intelligence. Killing these two operatives and crippling Niskanen's ability to send in other enemies doesn't do that. More agents will follow these two, if not from Finland, then perhaps through Turkey or Poland. How thin can we spread our resources tracking them?
Wouldn't it be better to know more about how they operate and to try to get them to work for us?
While Orlov spoke, Roski's expression had shaded from annoyance to anger. When the general was finished, his deputy hooked back a sleeve and looked at his watch.
The agents apparently hope to arrive before sunup, which will be in a little over 4 hours. You'd best give me your decision very soon.
I need to know what resources you can spare to watch them, Orlov said as his phone beeped, and whether the man Pogodin caught in Moscow can help us. He reached behind himself and put the phone on speaker in an effort to mollify Roski. If the colonel was grateful, he didn't show it.
Yes, Orlov said. Sir, it's Zilash. Nearly 90 minutes ago, we picked up a rather odd communication from Washington.
In what way odd? Orlov asked.
It was a heavily scrambled message to an aircraft flying from Berlin to Helsinki, said Zilash. Corporal Yevashin ordered satellite reconnaissance of the aircraft, though the flight path took it under heavy cloud cover. Intentionally, it appears. We were able to get a couple of good looks at it through breaks. The aircraft is an Il-76T.
Orlov and Roski exchanged glances. For the moment, their feud was forgotten.
Where is the plane now? Orlov asked. On the ground in Helsinki, sir.
Roski leaned forward.
Zilash, were you able to see a number?
No, Colonel, but it's an Il-76T. We're sure of that.
A lot of planes are being shifted around, Orlov said to Roski. Someone might be using the opportunity to defect.
Two other possibilities come to mind, Roski said. The team Valya has been watching may be a feint to draw our attention from some other mission, or the U.S. is running two entirely different operations from Finland.
Orlov agreed.
We'll know more when we see where the Il-76T is headed, he said. Zilash, keep following the plane and let me know the instant you have anything else.
Yes, sir.
As Orlov punched off the speaker, Roski took a step toward him.
General.
Orlov looked up. Yes?
If the plane enters Russian airspace, the Air Force will want to bring it down, the way they did that Korean Airlines jet. They should be alerted.
I agree, said Orlov. Though with a wall of radar and other early warning devices, it would be suicidal to try.
Under ordinary circumstances, yes, said Roski.
but with the heavy increase in military air traffic over the past few days, it wouldn't surprise me if the plane simply tried to slip in and lose itself somewhere.
Point well taken, Orlov said.
And the boat? Rusky asked. We're obliged to inform the Navy.
I know what we're required to do, Orlov cut in. But that one is mine, Colonel.
Let them land, watch them, and tell me exactly what they're up to.
Rusky's jaw shifted.
Yes, sir,
he said, saluting without enthusiasm. And Colonel?
Yes, sir.
Do your best to ensure that nothing happens to the crew. Your very best. I don't want to lose any more foreign agents.
I always do my best, sir,
Rusky said as he saluted again and left the office. Chapter 36, Tuesday, 12:26 a.m., Helsinki. The South Harbor district of Helsinki is famous not just for the crowded market square that adjoins the presidential palace, but for the boat rides which leave for Suomenlinna Island several times a day. Nestled at the entrance to the harbor, this imposing Gibraltar of the North is home to an open-air theater, a military museum, and an imposing 18th-century castle. Adjacent Seurasaari Island is connected to the mainland by bridge and is the site of the Olympic Stadium, which hosted the 1952 Games. At night, the landmarks are dark silhouettes against the darker skies. Had they been visible, Peggy James still would not have seen them. Major Aho had given her an automobile and explicit directions. 15 minutes after he'd gone to the airport with two decoys in his command, she'd driven herself and Private George to the harbor and the cruiser that would take them to Kotka and the mini-sub. She had no time nor interest in sightseeing. She had just one thing on her mind, getting into St. Petersburg.